dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the War of Ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. Who better to talk about intelligence in this war for the free world than a man who spent most of his life in the uniform of the United States Navy studying and practicing the business of intelligence, specifically intelligence vis-a-vis communist China and the growing threat that he, in a very clear-eyed and courageous way, over decades of service in the Navy, called to the attention of his superiors and others of us, mostly, regrettably, without the desired effect. His name is Captain James Fennell, United States Navy retired. In the course of some 30 years of service, he rose through the ranks to become the Chief Intelligence Officer for the U.S. Pacific Fleet. And in that capacity, he had a ringside seat monitoring what the Chinese Navy and the Chinese military more generally and the Chinese Communist Party, for whom, of course, the People's Liberation Army works, were up to. What were they planning to do? What were their ambitions specifically for the United States, for freedom more generally? And this is all playing out as we speak with Jim today, against the backdrop of the Chinese Communist Party acting within, well, now hours, to shrink the free world. That will be the effect of its takedown of a once free, once British colony called Hong Kong. To talk about that and much more, I'm very pleased to welcome back a distinguished military officer, a former naval officer, as Winston Churchill used to call himself, and a great American patriot. Jim Fennell, thank you so much for taking a few minutes to talk with us on this momentous occasion. Welcome back. So, Jim, you were one of, I think, something on the order of 89 signatories on a letter that our Committee on the Present Danger, China, of which you are a founding member, I'm very happy to say, circulated over the past couple of days and sent to the President of the United States yesterday, urging him to both respond to a huge national security problem and do it in, well, the moment when the Hong Kong people desperately need evidence of our strong support. And the Chinese Communist Party certainly deserves punishment. Talk a little bit, if you would, about these 20 Chinese People's Liberation Army companies that are operating inside the United States and what the significance of that, well, that level of penetration in our economy, in our society, in our technology base, in our national security more generally, reconstitutes.
Well, Frank, when I look at this list of these 20 companies that the Pentagon released, I see, you know, the Aviation Industry Corporation of China, which, you know, provides much of the PLA Air Force's technology and buildup. I see two of the shipbuilding industries from China, which has now been merged. The China Shipbuilding Corporation is now a single largest military shipbuilding company in the world. And just in those two areas that I know a little bit about, the idea that Americans would allow these companies to be brought into the U.S. Essentially stock market and allowed American people to buy and trade and sell and promote these companies is buying and selling and promoting the buildup of the Chinese military that's turned around to be focused on killing us. I mean, that's their stated goal. They want to dispel the United States from the Indo-Pacific region, the expel, and they want to dispel our influence and power, and they are ready to use military force to achieve those ends. So it's really hard for me to wrap my head around the idea that we would allow the very companies that are building weapons to kill our own people in a conflict. I'm not saying that they want to do it today, but when push comes to shove and they don't get what they want, they're going to use military force like we're seeing them threaten Taiwan with right now, like we're seeing in the line of actual control on the border with India, where they just had a skirmish over the last month and killed some 20 Indian soldiers, and what they're doing in the South China Sea. And even people don't talk about how they've basically unleashed Kim Jong-un in this last 6-8 weeks and caused him to, rise up again and cause another controversy. So on four fronts, the Korean Peninsula, Taiwan, the South China Sea, and on the Indian subcontinent on the border, China is physically threatening people with violence in some form or fashion. And the idea that American taxpayers, people that are hardworking Americans, civilians that may not know this, would invest their money unknowingly sometimes because they're in the, mutual funds that would hide the direct investment, just seems absolutely absurd. And so I'm really glad to see these letters come out, and I'm glad to see the Pentagon list them. I'm glad to see, the senators like Senator Cotton and others willing to stand up and say, this has to stop.
Amen. I want to come back to the military implications of all this, Jim Fennell, but let me just stay with the problem at hand. Unfortunately, well, you're absolutely right. These People's Liberation Army companies, or as the Pentagon calls them, communist Chinese military companies, are, many of them at least, actually getting money out of our stock market, bilking our stock market. Investors is the way I think of it. They're also doing joint ventures in our country. They're also buying up companies in our country with impunity. And Jim, you know a lot about the Chinese. You're familiar, of course, especially with what's known as the Chinese National Intelligence Act that, as I understand it, requires Chinese companies and nationals to collect intelligence, to steal technology, to otherwise serve the interests of the motherland on demand of Beijing. And if that's true of every other company, you can imagine what a priority mission it is for the People's Liberation Army itself. So, Jim, what does this mean from an intelligence, a counterintelligence point of view, if these companies are gaining access to our technology or intellectual property, our companies, and our society more generally in this fashion?
Well, it means that they've been able to leapfrog the normal progression that other nations have had to follow over the last, 60, 70 years since the end of the war, World War II, where nations would have to evolutionarily develop their own technology, their own indigenous understanding of complex systems like an aircraft carrier, a stealth fighter, or something of that nature. And China, because they've been in our system, they've just stolen all that technology. And we can see it in the development of their, you just look at their resources of the PLA and you can see, wow, look at that. The O-type 075 amphibious helicopter ship looks just like a, one of the United States exact same WASP class. Or you look at a J-20 stealth fighter in China, it looks just like an F-35. It doesn't just look like it. It's got much of the same components on the inside because they just essentially leapfrogged past doing their own hard work and taken ours.
They've ripped it off, in other words. Hey, Jim, we have to take a short break. We'll come back to this point because I know it's going to set up the conversation we need to have about what all these weapons they've ripped off from us mean in terms of the future threat we face militarily from the Chinese Communist Party and its People's Liberation Army right after this with Jim Fennell.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
We're back. We're visiting with Captain James Fennell, United States Navy retired, one of our go-to guys on national security matters in general, but particularly with respect to China. He is a member of the Committee on the Present Danger, China, and an extraordinarily highly regarded intelligence professional whose insights into what we are facing from Communist China and its People's Liberation Army and its People's Liberation Army Navy is as good as any you can find anywhere in the world today. So, Jim, I apologize for having to interrupt you, but you were just making a point about the cumulative effect of this leapfrogging, as you say, the cost avoidance on the one hand, the ability to bring to bear capabilities far more rapidly than would otherwise be the case, and presumably the actual qualitative benefit to them as well, and what that means for the so-called qualitative edge that we've long enjoyed. Finish that thought, if you would.
Yes, Frank. I mean, your point is well made, which is not only did they rip us off and steal all this technology, very sensitive military technology that gives them a qualitative equality or superiority to us in some areas, like anti-ship cruise missiles, for instance, but they've also been able to build up their military rapidly with that technology, not having to divert funds into research and development, but right into production. So they've done that over the last 20 years, and now they present a force that's equal to or greater than ours, certainly in the Western Pacific. But there's another effect to this, which is because our own stock market has allowed these companies to be invested and in infiltrated, they've not just stolen our technology, they've stolen our resources. They've taken American investor money, and instead of investing it into American companies to build up America's military, it's gone in to build up the Chinese military. So, for instance, one of my passions is the fact that the United States Navy doesn't have enough warships and submarines to be able to counter the great number of warships and submarines that the PLA Navy has. Well, part of that reason is because instead of investing in and building up our own ships, that money in some form or fashion has been going to the Chinese. And that really has put us at a great disadvantage when it comes down to being able to fight and win a war at sea as China continues their expansion across the Pacific and into the Indian Ocean. And I think this is something that doesn't get a much attention. And it's really one of the things that you hear in Washington inside the Beltway there is whenever somebody like me brings up the fact that we don't have enough ships, I'm always told by the quote unquote realists, well, that's because there's not enough money and enough shipyards to be able to build the things that we need. It's just not doable. Well, part of the reason it's not doable is because we've debilitated our own shipbuilding industry and aircraft and aviation industries because we've given this money to China in large part. So that has to stop, or otherwise we're never going to be able to compete in the military arena. And when we cannot compete militarily, the rest of this comes undone.
This is such an important point, and I'm so appreciative that you've made it, and so well, Captain Fennell. We, it seems, can't get our head quite around the idea. At least when I say we, I don't think it's you, it's not me, it's not our Committee on the Present Danger, China, obviously. But an awful lot of capitalists, a lot of financial mavens in Wall Street particularly, a lot of the elite in American foreign policy circles, who've been your bets noir for a long time, Jim, persist in holding out this idea that China is something other than our enemy. And I don't mean China, the people. I mean the Chinese Communist Party is clearly our enemy. And yet, there was a remarkable exchange that my friend Maria Bartiromo had with the Attorney General of the United States the other day, in which she told him about an interview she'd recently had with one of these masters of the universe on Wall Street. I believe it was Ron Dalio, a major figure on Wall Street. And he basically said, I can't be bothered worrying about who are the good guys and the bad guys. China's a good investment, and I'm going to put my money there. And the AG sort of lit guys like that up in response. And he said something to the effect of, these guys are so focused on the next quarter bottom line, they're missing the long-term picture, let alone the national interests. He said they're focused on their stock options and getting into the Gulf resort. And he said if we had a similar attitude back in the 1940s, we'd all be speaking German today. Your thoughts?
I think the Attorney General is exactly right. Those words are exactly the way I feel, which is we don't really understand the strategic intentions of the Chinese Communist Party. We haven't listened to what they've told us. Mao's told us what he wants. Deng told us. Jiang Zemin told us. Hu Jintao told us. And Xi Jinping has clearly told us what their strategic end states are. And the fact that people wouldn't accept those is a statement about their moral ineptness, in my opinion, because they're not doing their due diligence to protect the country that's allowed them to have the businesses that they're so, you know, as they claim, hey, I'm here to protect my shareholders. Well, you won't have shareholders to protect when China takes it over. And I know that sounds extreme and far-fetched, but the fact is China is on the march, and they've been stealing our technology, and they've been outbuilding us, and we keep telling ourselves, don't worry about it, look the other way, it's a great investment over there, and we keep declining and declining and declining. And when we are declined to such a state that China doesn't worry about us, they will take military action, and they have a strategy, and they're on their timeline, and if we don't disrupt it, it's not going to be very well for us.
Well, this is really what I wanted to get to with you, Jim, because again, this is not some theory. You have really studied these Chinese leaders, their stated strategies and policies. You've closely monitored what they're doing to execute the programs, the technology theft and application and all the rest of it to give them the capability to take us on. And as Sun Tzu, the famous Chinese strategist, said, of course, it's better to win without fighting. And I'd like you to talk about two things, Jim. One is it possible that they become so powerful that they could conceivably, especially when combined with the other elements of the so-called unrestricted warfare that they've been waging against us, essentially defeat us without having to fight us, point one. And point two, if they do decide, whether by miscalculation perhaps, or just because they, for their own internal reasons, need to act militarily, that they could defeat us decisively in the Pacific for sure, and perhaps beyond, in a way that would really translate into the defeat that would make the shrinking of the free world by the loss of Hong Kong pale into insignificance.
Yeah, Frank, I think the Chinese are hoping that they won't ever have to come to the point where they actually use the military force, because we will be so weak and decrepit, both from a physical military defensive standpoint and an economic standpoint, but also from a, you know, kind of an internal, you know, society perspective, where we're just not willing to draw the line anymore and say, we will not allow you to come any further and we will defend this. And I think that's their hope. I was reading Jonathan Ward's book, China's Vision of Victory, that came out last year, and he has a quote from Mao from 59 that says, "One day, sooner or later, America will certainly let go of the Western Pacific places and withdraw back home, just like it had to let go of other regions in the world. If they don't go themselves, there will be a day when the people of each country will unite and throw them out." I mean, that's you know, many, many years ago, over 60 years ago, that Mao told his people that this is what was going to happen. And I think that's their vision, is that we're just going to corrode internally and somebody's just going to come along and just kind of wave a feather at us and we're going to fall over. And that's the real test of us right now, is whether or not we're going to recognize this threat and reverse course. We have a lot of capital in terms of our relationships with many nations in the region, in the Western Pacific and the Indo-Pacific. We have a strong economy still. But we have to get our minds around the idea that this is an existential threat, and that we can't just partner or have, some kind of friendly competition with the Chinese. It's not friendly. It is a kill or be killed atmosphere, and they want to take over and run a new global governance system. And that will be a system whereby the United States will not have a say in how things are run and said or done anymore. And if you think wearing a mask is something that's just one little thing that the Chinese could inflict on us, think about how far that could go in terms of the way they're right now controlling Chinese citizens' ability to walk out of their own houses without having an app that says, yep, you're green, you're good, you can walk out of your house. Oh, you want to go in the store? Hold on, let's check your app. Oh, you want to get on a train? Check your app. Check the app to get on a plane. Oh, you want your children to go to school? Well, we need to make sure that you've got the right social credit score. I mean, this is the world that they live in. And if we don't want that, then we're going to have to stand up and fight for it.
Amen, Captain Fennell. As always, this is a clarion call. I guess I would just say, in response to what you've described here, Mao, back in the day, probably could not have contemplated having the military power that the Chinese Communist Party does today. And therefore, he was talking about perhaps, you know, popular uprisings or people's war. And interestingly enough, Jim Fennell, as you know, but I think practically nobody else in our country does, The Chinese Communist Party actually has declared people's war against the United States last year. And you mentioned the masks. You mentioned what prompted it. The Chinese Communist Party virus, I think of it as, is an example of an instrument of that kind of people's war or unrestricted warfare. And there's so much else that is now afoot. As you say, they are on the march. We ignore it at our peril. We keep investing in its buildup at our extreme risk. And of course, at the risk of not having the capabilities we need militarily and otherwise to defend this great republic. Thank you for your service to our great republic, Jim, both that you've provided in uniform and that you are continuing to render these days at the Geneva Center for Security Policy, not to be confused with the real one here in Washington, D.C., which we are happy to be part of. Jim Fennell, again, thank you so much for your time, as always, and we'll look forward to visiting with you again in the near future. In the meantime, stay well, my friend. God bless you. We'll be right back with Jim Fennell straight ahead.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. We are visiting with Jim Fennell, United States Navy captain, retired naval intelligence officer of great renown, a man who has continued to serve his country, now out of uniform, from overseas, where he is a senior fellow with the Geneva Center for Security Policy, not to be confused with ours in Washington, D.C. But Jim is doing great work there, and we are very pleased to have him with us. So Jim, tell us, as you see it, as a trained intelligence officer, what you're seeing in the ways of actual conduct and what might be called in your trade indicators and warnings of conduct to come from the Chinese Communist Party in, say, the South China Sea, for starters.
Well, Frank, in the South China Sea, the PRC, the balance of power, if you will, in terms of naval forces, China is now greater than the U.S., orders of magnitude 5 to 10, somewhere between 5 and 10 to 1. So for every 5 or 10 Chinese warships and planes that are down in the South China Sea, we may have one on any given day. And the Chinese have built this up since I retired in 2015, but I started watching obviously well before that when they started their activity at Scarborough Shoal and took that from the Philippines. And then they also built these 7 artificial islands down in the Spratlys. And over the course of this almost last decade, China has built up their continuous presence in the South China Sea. And so now, whenever we operate down there, the Chinese characterize it in the international press as the United States being the provocateurs and of changing, you know, and militarizing the South China Sea. But it's a complete reversal of the truth. And it's been China that has militarized the South China Sea and these artificial islands. And they're now shadowing any foreign military that operates down there, which is predominantly the United States Navy, the 7th Fleet. But it's also, we have our allies from Australia and some friends from India and whatnot, Japan, our friends there operating. And the Chinese will make sure that they follow these ships, and they warn them that they haven't permission from the Chinese government to operate in the South China Sea. And then we go into this pandemic, and they made sure through information warfare to highlight the activities of the U.S. Navy having cases of the virus on our USS Theodore Roosevelt, which is now still in Port Guam, and a couple of cases on the USS Ronald Reagan, which is our permanently deployed forward void carrier out in Japan. And so the Chinese have extensively used information warfare to diminish the capability or characterize the United States Navy as a diminished capacity and not able to meet its mission and not able to get underway and things of this nature, while at the same time sending their aircraft carriers down into the South China Sea to operate and conduct exercises and operations. And so they've also done this around Taiwan as well. So during the pandemic, when everybody theoretically is focused on, you know, fighting the virus and solving the crisis with the virus, we've seen China a little bit ramp up their operations around Taiwan and make threatening kind of statements and innuendos. And we've seen new activity with their Y-20 bomber activity. And we've seen paradrop training. We've seen all these little military indicators that suggest China is purposefully, at the time of this crisis, demonstrating to the region that, hey, while the United States isn't able to operate its military because they screwed up on the virus, which is a lie, by the way, but we, the PLA, are able to operate fully. And then you get some really hot rhetoric that came out a couple of weeks ago, where you have the Global Times, which is really what I call the heart and the window into the heart and soul of the Chinese Communist Party. Their senior editor talking about, you know, the necessity for the PRC to ramp up their nuclear warheads to 1,000 warheads immediately or very soon because of the threat from the United States. So there's a lot of bellicose talk going on right now from what some people would claim is, well, this is their hawkish newspaper and you shouldn't pay too much attention to it. But more and more we see the Global Times reflecting the leading edge of what Xi Jinping and the Chinese Communist Party are thinking and their attitudes towards the United States.
You said a number of things that are worth teasing out a little bit. Let me start by saying the 5-to-1 ratio that you mentioned in terms of the relative strength of the Chinese in this one area of the world compared to what the United States, which has global responsibilities, is able to put in the region, is stunning. To some extent, we have consoled ourselves over the years by saying that we have superior quality of arms. We certainly have, we think, superior men and women who are trained to utilize them if, God forbid, they are needed to. But talk a little bit about the qualitative net assessment, if you would, Jim. Are we still ahead? And Stalin, I think it was, who said quantity has a quality all its own. Even if we do, is it now being overmatched by what the Chinese are putting into place?
In my opinion, yes. I think that we have, over the course of the Obama years, we watched our Navy shrink to its lowest level in my lifetime. And it was wrong. And right now, this administration's done a lot to arrest the that decline in that slide. And they're building up our readiness accounts so that our ships can spend more time at sea. And this administration is doing much more in the South China Sea. We had two South China Sea freedom of navigation operations were conducted just in 2 days in April. We're conducting more Taiwan Strait transit. So we're doing more with the few assets that we have. But the real debate is the size of the fleet, the size of our air forces to compete with the numbers that the Chinese have. And in that, and that's in part because the Chinese naval vessels that they're putting to sea are equal to us in terms of their ability to steam and sail and get, you know, satellite communications and things of that nature. But the area where the Chinese have excelled is in anti-ship cruise missiles. And so the Chinese fleet today has a superior capability in high-speed anti-ship cruise missiles over the United States Navy. And we've recognized this. We're still playing catch-up. But it's something that's very, very serious. And so not only do we need more platforms that spread out and disperse the ability for the Chinese to attack us, but we need to equip our ships with anti-ship cruise missiles that have equal to or longer range than the Chinese and that can be used to sink the Chinese fleet while it's still inside the first island chain. So I see this as a kind of a two-pronged problem. Our ships don't have anti-ship cruise missiles to the range and the capabilities as the PLA Navy. They're not they're supersonic. Theirs are. Ours don't have long range. Ours are older technology. The new ones that are coming on haven't been tested as well and aren't as in the same quality of numbers. And then we just don't have the same number of ships that they do. And this is, to me, it's been a continuing concern while I was in the Navy and for the last 5 years. It's really been one of my big issues is that we need to, as a nation, recognize that we need to go on a shipbuilding campaign.
Again, a lot to talk about here. I want to come back to your point about a possible nuclear buildup, but just staying with the conventional capabilities and needs. The Chinese have been, it seems, innovating a lot in addition to, you know, the kinds of anti-ship missiles that you're talking about, which, by the way, include ballistic missiles as well, carrier-killing ballistic missiles, they call them. There's also, it seems, a lot of experimentation with and presumably deployment of, at least in due course, swarms of autonomous vehicles in the air, on the surface, subsurface perhaps as well, that are designed to inexpensively
overwhelm the kinds of defenses that we have, such as they are. Talk a little bit about what you're seeing in those realms, Jim, and how serious a problem you think that represents to our ability to maintain, you know, freedom of navigation, not just for ourselves and our commercial vessels, but for the world in waters that the Chinese are now insistently claiming as their own, the South China Sea, and I guess to some extent the East China Sea as well, right?
Right. Definitely in the East China Sea. The Chinese have clearly, you know, they're very good at stealing technology and reading everything that we write because we're so transparent in our annual defense department budget submissions and all the work that all the contractors do in D.C. and around the country that, you know, advertise our capabilities. And so they've gone to school on this. And so they're very quickly have adopted unmanned autonomous, platform operations, whether it's UAVs, that the drones that we see that are, oh, by the way, this company DJI, it's all over, you know, sells to the majority of the American drone market, which is now changing. But for the last many, many years, they have been dominating that market. And they've done that in China. And so with the PLA and the PLA Air Force and their reconnaissance forces and even weaponized drones. And they're doing the same thing in the surface waters, autonomous vehicles that can operate, as you mentioned, in swarms and in drones and attack. And we've seen some, you know, bits and pieces of advertising about that in terms of their, you know, what they put on their web and show. And so they're aware of this. And we see it in things like their celebrations for the Chinese New Year's, where you see these drones that are flying over Shanghai or Hong Kong with all these fireworks going off that are being done by, instead of fireworks, they're using drones to simulate a fireworks show. So they've made a lot of advances in that, and also, as you mentioned, in the undersea. So it's an area that we are also heavily invested in the Department of Defense. And so there's a bit of a competition there. But what it means is that numbers count still. And if you can field enough platforms that can be operated autonomously, that can deliver weapons to sink other platforms, especially high-value platforms like a U.S. aircraft carrier, then that's what the Chinese are trying to do. What they're trying to do is, what we call it A2AD, anti-access area denial. They call it counterintervention. They don't want us to operate inside that first island chain. And they really, to be honest, don't want us to operate inside the second island chain all the way to Guam. They've put a lot of attention in these two island chains, and they're big. Obviously, the second one's much bigger than the first one, but they're slowly chipping away at it. And so it's putting a big strain on us. I think that's why the president created the Space Force, because all of these autonomous vehicles are going to be dependent upon satellite communications and satellite capabilities. And so having a dedicated group of Americans that are able to understand that domain and be able to dominate in the case of a crisis is smart thinking.
Jim Fennell, we have to take a break. We'll be right back with our final segment with Jim Fennell of the Geneva Center for Security Policy, former Naval Intelligence Officer and United States Navy Captain, retired. Straight ahead.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back to our fourth and final segment with Captain Jim Fennell, United States Navy, retired, a career intelligence professional who is sharing with us his intelligence in every sense of the word about communist China and the threat that it represents to us. Jim, again, thank you for your time. One other thing that you mentioned earlier that I wanted to double back on is the Global Times, I think it was, you said, has been particularly bellicose of late, mentioning that China needs to increase to 1,000 the number of warheads that it has. I have a sneaking suspicion, but I'd be very interested in your best intelligence assessment, Jim, that the Chinese have long since had over 1,000 nuclear warheads. We talk about it a lot on the program, and I think I've discussed it with you before as well, that there's said to be 3,000 miles of hardened underground tunnels in China that they use to hide and presumably operate their nuclear forces, suggesting that it's quite a bit larger force than just 1,000 warheads. What's your assessment, sir?
Yeah, this is a report that came out of Global Times from their senior editor, Hu, on the 5th or the 8th of May. And he said, We need to expand. China needs to expand the number of nuclear warheads to 1,000 in a relatively short time because we need a large nuclear arsenal to curb, quote, curb the U.S. strategic ambition and impulses towards China. And when you looked at that, you said, wow, that's pretty amazing. So they're upset about what's going on with the virus and the way the president's been pressuring them about covering it up. And they immediately go right up the the ladder, right to talking about expanding their nuclear arsenal. That's really scary. But as you mentioned, I believe they already had 1,000 warheads, even though the official number is, I think, 290 warheads that are put out by our DOD in the annual report to Congress. Obviously, the DOD can't report sensitive classified information, so there's in all likelihood that the number is much bigger than what the DOD's official report is. But from my own experience in this business, we have, as an intelligence community, routinely underestimated the capabilities of the PRC. And in 2012, Dr. Phil Carber did a study with his undergraduate and graduate students at the university that he teaches at and in D.C. there, Georgetown. And he showed that, through open source analysis of, commercial imagery and the things that the Chinese have written online, that there was somewhere around 3,000 miles of tunnels in China. And I was recently in a discussion with somebody that said, let's just say that Dr. Carver's analysis was wrong by an order of magnitude of two times. So maybe it's only 1,000 miles of tunnels, okay, which I'm not saying that it is, but just assume that it's lower than even what that open source analysis said. That's still much more than what we had, I think, believed and known. It would allow the Chinese to have many more missiles and warheads than we currently estimate. And so this announcement by the Global Times could be just a precursor that in 6 months from now, we're going to see a revelation where the Chinese roll out some of this and take it out of their tunnels to let us take a look at it and then hide it again. And to remind us now that if they try to screw with us in any way, that they're more inclined to use nuclear weapons, which they've had, hawkish generals talk about using to vaporize Los Angeles and Seattle and Portland and whatnot. So we must remember that we're in an ideological struggle with the PRC, and for them it's I win, you die, and they don't want to use the military. I'm not suggesting that, but I am suggesting that they have built up a military to be able to have the capabilities to do the kinds of things that they want to do to pressurize people, and they are now openly talking about their nuclear arsenal, something that would have been, kind of not really too common very long ago. And of course, in this op-ed, the first day it came out was on a Friday, and then it followed up over the weekend. And this editor from Global Times pulled it back a bit and said, well, we still have the policy of no first use. And he said all the right things that would appease the appeasers in the United States Sinology crowd, if you will. But the fact is, the engagers, accommodationists, the appeasers, these people will use those comments and not focus on the actual statement about, hey, we need to have more nuclear missiles. And I think that should have been on the front page of the New York Times, the Washington Post, the Wall Street Journal, that Chinese Global Times editor talks about, increasing China's nuclear arsenal because they feel threatened by the United States, who's asking to investigate the origins of the virus.
But Jim, as a serious student of these matters, of course, not just what the Chinese media is, of course, propaganda through and through, but propaganda instruments, I should say, through and through, but also our own media, which has generally been highly deferential to the Chinese Communist Party, especially the outlets like the New York Times and the Washington Post that get millions of dollars per year for advertising Chinese propaganda in their papers, as you know. But we're also seeing, of course, a general neglect on the part of our media, and to be honest, many people in public life as well, about the really appalling shape of our nuclear deterrent. What you described in terms of our Navy's inadequacies, sadly, is, I think, if anything, even more true of our nuclear forces. And the president is trying to remedy that, but it's slow going. And I think we're desperately behind the eight ball. So when we hear these sorts of threats from the Chinese, we ignore them at our extreme peril, it seems to me. Jim, let me quickly turn to one other question. question for you. The Belt and Road Initiative, you talked a considerable length about what's happening in the Western Pacific, but talk a little bit about what the Chinese ambitions and actual activities are now, both in terms of building out infrastructure of the old-fashioned kind, but also now the digital kind worldwide, and to what end?
Frank, this One Belt, One Road, or the Belt and Road Initiative, is, you know, the Chinese are now 7 years into this since Xi Jinping really kind of unleashed it as a national policy for the PRC. And they've got a network and a web that goes from China all the way into Europe with rail lines that are, you know, rolling in Chinese goods into Europe. And it goes through the maritime domains, through the Indian Ocean, into Europe and into the Mediterranean. They're working into the Arctic with a presence in the Arctic and passages again to Europe through the Arctic. And then they have also got another vector that goes down into the South Pacific and into Oceania. And this Belt and Road Initiative is, again, it's an economic, predominantly an economic posture in terms of establishing trading posts, if you will, in all these countries that allows the Chinese to be the single source provider of this goods and services, and allows this economic relationship with the what you'd call the South, the Great South, and these countries that have been kind of what you'd call developing nations. But it also involves diplomacy and the fact of their ability of their diplomats to be in these countries, helping set policies, helping the Chinese get their vision across, so that these nations, when they go to institutions like the United Nations or the World Health Organization, the World Trade Organizations, or the International Monetary Fund, that China's interests are represented through a whole new network of, quote, I wouldn't call them alliances, but people that are sympathetic, nations that are sympathetic to China's concerns because they're beholden for economic reasons. And then it also includes the movement of the military out to these areas. And so we see Chinese ships arriving in all these ports inside the Mediterranean and into the Baltic and down in this new base that they have down in Africa on the East Coast there in Djibouti, and, you know, integration with in Pakistan and other areas in Myanmar. There's reporting coming out of what the Chinese are doing to help Myanmar and their situation with the Rohingya there. So there's the Chinese are just, it's like a web, and they're using money to buy off people. When I was down in the South Pacific last year, there was reports of politicians being bribed with, you know, suitcases of money so that those people would be sympathetic and usher in Chinese access and ports and railroads and things of this nature. So it's part of China's grand strategy to, you know, basically establish a new world global governance scheme. And this Belt and Road is the connective economic tissue, diplomatic tissue, and what I believe increasingly become a series of military installations and bases, all designed to support China's worldview and to displace the United States.
World ambitions, world dominance agenda. We have to leave it at that, Jim Fennell. The time flies by. There is simply not enough to get into all of the details that you are so knowledgeable about, but we do appreciate our periodic efforts to try, and we look forward to having you back very soon again, Jim. Thanks as much as anything for what you're doing to help the rest of us really understand the threat through your work at the Red Star Rising Google Group, as well as what you do with the Committee on the Present Danger China, which is deeply appreciated. People, again, you can find information about all of the things that we're talking about here, both from Jim Fennell and others, at presentdangerchina.org. Please check it out. Jim, come back to us again soon, if you would. In the meantime, stay well, my friend. Hope the rest of you will come back to us again tomorrow, same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.